Robert was quite right. Young Frank was far more mature than his brother had been at the same age. He had the same icy blue eyes and shock of bushy black hair. Born with Oppenheimer lankiness, he would soon stand 6 feet but weigh a mere 135 pounds. He was in many ways as gifted intellectually as his brother, but seemed unburdened by Robert's intense nervous energy. If Robert could sometimes seem manic in his obsessions, Frank was a calming presence and ever congenial. As an adolescent, Frank had known his brother at a distance, mainly through his letters and during vacations when they had gone sailing together. It was during this trip to New Mexico, without their parents, that Frank bonded with his sibling as an adult. When the brothers arrived in Los Pinos, they bunked at Catherine Page's ranch, and despite his persistent coughing, Robert insisted on mounting a series of extended expeditions on horseback into the surrounding hills. They'd make do with a little peanut butter, some canned artichokes, Vienna sausages and Kirschwasser, and whiskey. As they rode, Frank would listen as Robert talked excitedly about physics and literature. At night, the older brother would pull out a worn copy of Baudelaire and read aloud by the light of a campfire. That summer of 1928, Robert was also reading the 1922 novel The Enormous Room, an account by E.E. Cummings of his four-month incarceration in a French wartime prison camp. He loved Cummings' notion that a man stripped of all his possessions can nevertheless find personal freedom in the most Spartan of surroundings. The story would take on a new meaning for him after 1954. Frank Oppenheimer noticed that his brother's passions were always mercurial. Robert seemed to divide the world into people who were worth his time and those who were not. For the former group, Frank said, it was wonderful. Robert wanted everything and everyone to be special, and his enthusiasms communicated themselves and made these people feel special. Once he had accepted someone as worthy of attention or friendship, he would always be ringing or writing them, doing them small favors, giving them presents. He couldn't be humdrum. He would even work up those enthusiasms for a brand of cigarettes, even elevating them to something special. His sunsets were always the best. Frank observed that his brother could like all manner of people. They could be famous or not, but in liking them, he had a way of making these people into heroes. Anybody who struck him with their wisdom, talent, skill, decency, or devotion became, at least temporarily, a hero to him, to themselves, and to his friends. One day that July, Catherine Page took the Oppenheimer brothers on a ride about a mile up into the mountains above Los Pinos. After riding through a pass at 10,000 feet, they came upon a meadow perched on Grass Mountain and covered with thick clover and blue and purple alpine flowers. Ponderosa and white pine trees framed a magnificent view of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and the Pecos River. Nestled in the meadow at an altitude of 9,500 feet was a rustic cabin built from half trunks and adobe mortar. A hardened clay fireplace dominated one wall of the cabin, and a narrow wooden staircase led upstairs to two small bedrooms. The kitchen had a sink and wood stove, but there was no running water, and the only bathroom was a windy outhouse built at the end of a covered porch. "Like it?" Catherine asked Robert. When Robert nodded, she explained that the cabin and the 154 acres of pasture and brook were for rent.
"Hot dog!" Robert exclaimed.
"No, perro caliente," quipped Catherine,
translating Robert's exclamation into Spanish. Later that winter, Robert and Frank persuaded their father to sign a 4-year lease on the ranch. They named it Perro Caliente. They continued to lease it until 1947, when Oppenheimer purchased it for $10,000. The ranch would be Robert's private haven for years to come. After 2 weeks in New Mexico, the brothers left in the early fall of 1928 to join their parents at the luxurious Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs. Both Robert and Frank took some rudimentary driving lessons and then bought a used 6-cylinder Chrysler Roadster. Their plan was to drive to Pasadena. "We had a variety of mishaps," Frank said with understatement, "but finally got there." Outside of Cortez, Colorado, with Frank at the wheel, the car skidded on some loose gravel and landed upside down in a gully. The windshield was shattered and the car's cloth top was ruined. Robert fractured his right arm and two bones in his right wrist. After getting a tow to Cortez, they got the Roadster running again, but the very next evening Frank managed to run the car up onto a slab of rock. Unable to move, they spent the night lying on the desert floor, sipping from a bottle of spirits and sucking on some lemons we had with us. When they finally arrived in Pasadena, Robert went straight away to Caltech's Bridge Laboratory. With one arm in a bright red sling, he walked in, disheveled and unshaven, and announced, "I am Oppenheimer."
"Oh, are you Oppenheimer?"
replied a physics professor, Charles Christian Lortzen, who thought he looked more like a tramp than a college professor.
"Then you can help. Why am I getting the wrong results from this confounded cascade voltage generator?"
Oppenheimer was back in Pasadena only to pack his belongings and prepare for a return to Europe. Earlier that spring of 1928, he had received job offers from 10 American universities, including Harvard, and two from abroad. All of them were attractive positions with competitive salaries. Robert decided to accept a double appointment in the physics departments at the University of California, Berkeley, and Caltech. The plan was for him to teach one semester at each school. He chose Berkeley precisely because its physics program lacked any theoretical component. Berkeley was, in that sense, a desert. So for that reason, he thought it would be nice to try to start something. He did not intend to start something immediately, however, for at the same time Robert asked for, and shortly received, a fellowship so that he could return to Europe for another year. He felt that he still needed the seasoning, particularly in mathematics, that would come with an additional year of postdoctoral studies. He wanted to study under Paul Ehrenfest, a greatly admired physicist at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands. As he embarked for Leiden, his plan was that after a term with Ehrenfest, he might move on to Copenhagen, where he hoped to get to know Niels Bohr. In the event, Ehrenfest was out of sorts and distracted, suffering from one of his recurrent bouts of depression. "I don't think that I was of great interest to him then," Oppenheimer recalled. "I have a recollection of quiet and gloom." In retrospect, Robert thought he wasted his term in Leiden and that it was his own fault. Ehrenfest insisted on simplicity and clarity, traits that Robert had not yet embraced. "I probably still had a fascination with formalism and complication," he said, "so that the large part of what had me stuck or engaged was not his dish. And some of the things that were his dish, I didn't appreciate how really valuable it would be to have them in clear, good order." Ehrenfest thought Robert was too quick with his answers to any question, and sometimes hidden behind his quickness were errors. Ehrenfest, in fact, found it emotionally draining to work with the young man. "Oppenheimer is now with you," Max Born wrote his Leiden colleague. "I should like to know what you think of him. Your judgment will not be influenced by the fact that I have never suffered as much with anybody as with him. He is doubtless very gifted, but completely without mental discipline. He's outwardly very modest, but inwardly very arrogant." Ehrenfest's reply is lost, but Born's next letter is indicative. "Your information about Oppenheimer was very valuable to me. I know that he is a very fine and decent man, but you can't help it if someone gets on your nerves."